This is the new Talk the Bob Davis Podcasts, podcast 480, almost 500 podcasts, 20 podcasts away from 500 podcasts, which is hard to believe. But in this podcast, I'm going to talk about foreign policy. That's at least the title. That's the intended focus of this podcast. But there's so much stuff tied into all this in the wake of the Brussels attack that I'm not sure where we're going to go. So we're going to talk about the Brussels attack. We're going to talk about foreign policy in podcast 480, the Bob Davis Podcasts. If you think talking about foreign policy is a challenge, try being in business for yourself. And I know this now because there's always something that you have to think about. One of the biggest challenges for growing small businesses, or really any kind of business, is how you show your clients how much you appreciate them. You know, you thank them for their business and all that. You can take them to lunch or dinner. You can arrange some kind of outing, like a fishing trip or camping or something like that. You can send these promotional baubles with your company name on it to people. Most of the time, they end up in a drawer someplace forgotten about. Or the Minnesota Classic, which is a boat trip on a lake, except you have to wait till summer to do that. Or you can try something new. It's different. It's social. It's memorable. You can socialize and bond with your clients who are actually engaged in creating something unique and doing something really fun at Brush Studio in the West End, St. Louis Park. Brush Studio events are held in a relaxed and social setting. The Brush Studio people are event planning ninjas, so I guarantee you it's going to be a great event. Here's how it works. An artist will guide the people that you've brought, your clients, through a featured painting step by step. So they're going to come away with something of their own that they'll never forget. And you don't have to have any experience because it's not about the painting. Your client is going to be amazed at what they're able to create. I can tell you that now. Brush Studio events aren't about painting, but they're about socializing and working together and bonding. They have room for at least 55 people, plus catering from Crave in the West End. As I told you, they know how to do events. Brush Studio features over 22 brands of beer and an extensive wine collection. It's a fun, sophisticated way to create a new bonding experience. Your clients honestly will never forget, and they're going to love you for it, and they're going to want to go again, too. I guarantee it. So here's what you do. Check out the Brush Studio banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page, or visit brushstudio.net, B-R-U-S-H, studio, one word, brushstudio.net. You can call them, too, if you want to do it old school, 952-236-1700. That's 952-236-1700, Brush Studio in the West End, St. Louis Park. Well, whenever I tackle something like foreign policy, which I don't like to pop off about foreign policy. And the reason for that is I've said in many, many podcasts, foreign policy is a complicated thing. It's like law. It's like defense policy. And the people that do foreign policy, the people that do defense policy, the people that do international relations are like lawyers. Many of them are lawyers, or they are, they're academics most of the time. And I don't like to sound stupid when I talk about foreign policy or defense policy. I like to know specifically what I'm talking about. I like to be able to cite specific examples, but I can't in this podcast because things are too fast moving. This is one of those times, and I think I talked about this in one of the recent podcasts about media when I was talking about prepping and being overprepped. And whenever there was a crisis because of the fact that I was overprepped, and in other words, I read too much, I was able to just sit there, put everything aside and talk about stuff and take calls and interview experts without having to necessarily consult any notes or worry about writing out what I was going to say or anything else because, you know, I'm not saying I knew it all. I'm just saying I was really up to speed on everything that was going on. I've changed a little bit about how I do what I do, and I talked about that in podcast 479. And I'm really disturbed once again, and so this is why this is going to be a weird podcast because, you know, in talk radio, the rule is you have to say what you're going to talk about, and then you have to talk about that. And I've said I'm going to talk about Brussels, and I'm going to talk about foreign policy, and I am. But here again, we've now had three podcasts where media has played a role in the conversation. And so the media plays a role in a foreign policy discussion, whether it's about Brussels or it's about Donald Trump or it's about Ted Cruz or Hillary Clinton or any of the other presidential candidates and their supposed plans for foreign policy. The media is going to end up playing a role because the media is disseminating terrible information. Now, I was going to do a foreign policy podcast, and I think I may have actually mentioned it. 479 was going to be a foreign policy podcast. And then I thought, I'm going to just do a walk and talk because I need something a little lighter. It just felt like I needed something lighter. And the same thing was true for the podcast I did on Sunday night. That was going to be a foreign policy podcast. I just felt that, I should listen, because if I'd done it, I would have done it before the Brussels attack, and it would have been a lot more prescient than this one's going to be, just because I would have done it before Brussels. But the Brussels attack, and guess what? There will be another attack. There will be another, whether it's an airport or a mall or something that they will do, there will be another attack and there will be another reaction. So there'll be plenty of time to talk about that. And generally, we don't talk about the actual issues related to foreign policy and defense policy in the United States, particularly in an election year, because we're too busy arguing about who dissed whose wife and whether or not Hillary Clinton should go to jail, or why didn't the president come home from Cuba when this happened, even though it had nothing really to do with American citizens, although some American citizens were involved. Why did he go to a baseball game, and so on and so on and so on. These are the things we end up talking about. We don't talk about the nuts and bolts of foreign policy. We don't talk about the nuts and bolts of defense policy. And we're not going to get anywhere doing that. The other thing I've been doing this week is, that I spent about a week really investigating all of the end of the world predictions and, the planet that's coming in supposedly from outside the solar system and all these different things that are supposedly going on, which I talked about in a podcast last week. And now I've progressed to, all the conspiracy theory. The thing that's interesting is, if you go on YouTube and you look up the Illuminati, or you look up anybody that's involved in this stuff, you're going to see that these videos have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of views. And there's no guarantee of any kind of level of quality. And I think, in fact, I know that many people believe these conspiracy theories. They believe that the big banks are doing this. They believe it took about 24 hours before somebody to put up a video that called the Brussels attack a false flag attack. That is now a knee-jerk reaction to every single attack. Within 5 hours, somebody will post a video or write a story that will appear on Russia Today, which is called RT, which is a propaganda tool of the Russian government, or it'll appear in InfoWars, or both. It'll appear on RT first, which gives it a patina of legitimacy. Then it will appear in InfoWars, and it will say, well, this was a false flag attack because of this, this, and this, none of which prove that it was a false flag attack. And it's something that can never be disproven or proven, so it just lives out there. And hundreds of thousands of people watch this stuff, and they think that this video or that video is the same as CNN. In fact, the reason I brought it up is I'm going to go one step further. A lot of people don't watch regular news anymore. They watch stuff on YouTube, and that's how they get their information. I was once again, amused. It's very interesting. For months, I have been taking talk show hosts to task for jumping on the bandwagon behind particular candidates. And Finally, people have started to write about it. There's now been two stories. One that says if you want to blame someone for Trump, you should blame Limbaugh and Mark Levin and somebody else. And a second one in which a Baptist minister is taking Glenn Beck to task for saying that people aren't listening to their God if they vote for Donald Trump or support Donald Trump. And it was really amusing because you're going to see that as a storyline coming up. And it's a huge mistake for these guys to do this. And so it's amazing when I see someone who for years has said that people are sheeple. Americans don't know what's really going on. This is what's going on. It's an Illuminati thing. It's the Bilderbergers. It's this, that, and the other thing. And it's all the conspiracy theories tied together into one newscast after another with people to support it and everything else. And I was I'm not going to say I was shocked or taken aback, because I'm not shocked or taken aback, because that's what all of these guys are doing. They're all jumping on the bandwagon to support specific candidates because I guess that's what they think they have to do, whether they are being pushed in that direction by their tribe, their listeners or whatever, or they're being pushed in that direction because they feel this is the way that they have to remain relevant. But this is a guy that's called people, you know, sheeple because they don't know anything for years, who is now supporting Donald Trump for president because he knows what's going on. He understands the Illuminati conspiracy, and he knows that this is all a reptilian alien, conspiracy. And he knows, you know, he's got all this incredible knowledge about the stock markets, and he knows what the banks are doing and what's going on. And he's just dumbing down his speech for the general population. And it's like, wait a minute, you've been saying for years that people are stupid. Now you're supporting the guy that's been dumbing down his speech, aside from the fact that you've already jumped into the pool with your guy. So now you're hooked up to Donald Trump. Donald Trump may be many things, but Donald Trump is not necessarily an economist. Well, he isn't an economist. He's a real estate investor, and he certainly probably knows more about banking than I do, but he's not an expert on the complexities of the banking system or the international monetary system or economics or those other things. Donald Trump can't turn a switch and fix the economy just because he happens to have had some experience in banking or real estate. I would say, if anything, his experience is in marketing, not necessarily finance. If you want finance, you have to talk to economists. And if you know anything about finance, this is another thing. I found a video on YouTube today where the woman was going off. She starts out by saying, you know, and this has 100,000 views. I'm here to tell you today about a serious problem that is coming for America, and everybody needs to be aware of this, and you really need to listen to this because it's really, really important. There is going to be an economic meltdown either in 2016 or next year. Well, there's your out. Well, if it doesn't happen in 2016, then I'll just do 10 more videos in December of 2016 talking about how it's going to happen in 2017. And anybody who knows anything about the economy can tell you that sooner or later, there's going to be a recession, and it will result in unemployment, and it will result in higher or lower prices, depending on what the nature of it is, whether it's inflationary or deflationary, more than likely to be deflationary. These things happen regularly. It's called the cycle theory of economics. And it happens all the time. That's not news. We all know that. But the other thing is, if you spend any time at all reading the financial media, then you know that economists, traders, business people, hedge fund managers, news anchors for various outlets, they all are constantly writing and arguing and bickering back and forth about whether or not this indicator means that we're going to have a recession, or that indicator means that things are going to go up, what this special mathematic analysis of the market says, or what that says. And the reason is, it's like baseball. We have objective data for the stock market going back, like 200 years, and at the very least 100 years. So we have the same data that goes back 100 years like we do for baseball games. sense, right? Because baseball, the game of baseball hasn't changed appreciably in 100 years. So you can compare somebody's data from a game in 1914 to somebody's data in a game in 2014, 100 years later, and compare how those two games go. Well, the same thing's true with the stock market. So everybody has theories about whether things are going to get better or things are going to get worse on the market. And everybody and anybody can tell you the stock market isn't necessarily the whole economy. The stock market is, the stock market, and it's important, but it's not the whole economy. So this is what is passing for analysis, this kind of stuff. And I'm not talking about the financial guys. I'm talking about people putting up videos that say, we're going to have a depression or we're going to have a recession, which if you say it often enough, eventually will happen. Jim Rogers has made a whole career out of telling people that there's going to be a depression. And the latest is, what's his name? David Stockman. And I love David Stockman. I've interviewed David Stockman. He is providing a service by providing a certain point of view of what is happening in the markets, and he calls it a casino and everything else. But you can't easily explain with conspiracy theory every single thing that happens. And if you pay any attention to the mind-controlled sex slaves of the Illuminati, who will say things like, Gerald Ford was my handler, Clinton and Reagan took their orders from George H.W. Bush, and so on and so on, you'll find that most of the time the facts that prove this conspiracy or prove whatever they're telling you are they happen to hear a conversation from two people who are public personalities who are either dead or who you'll never get a confirmation from. Or I noticed they were talking about their ceremonies, and they'll show the scene from Eyes Wide Shut, which was shot at the Rothschild mansion, and shows, some weird ceremony as though that's proof that this is what the Illuminati does, because we have pictures from 1970 showing this party for Salvador Dali. Who knows? They could be doing that. Who knows what Eurotrash does or what these rich people do when they do what they do. But if it's true, great. But saying you heard something that somebody else said, or putting two things together that are not related, which are just basically pictures, or one is a dramatization that was in a movie with a picture of a party, does not prove that said conspiracy exists. It's just, but people will accept it as proof. And this is what goes for analysis in foreign policy, in domestic policy, and in now suddenly Donald Trump is the guy that knows about all this, and he's the outsider, and this is why all the Republican establishment guys are trying to get rid of him, and he's going to fix things. Well, he may or may not fix things. He may or may not get elected president. Who knows? But my feeling is the reason that the establishment opposes Donald Trump is not because they're in the Illuminati, whether they are or they aren't, or they're part of the Bilderbergers, whether they are or they aren't. It's because they're concerned that he will not be able to win the presidency. They may also be right or wrong, and they don't want to lose their grip on power because Donald Trump is not, quote unquote, an establishment candidate. And I've talked about that, and I don't need to go on and on talking about that. But this is what brings me to this foreign policy question. It isn't just low information. It's deeply misinformed people who are making comments and saying things about foreign policy that are frankly dangerous. And it isn't the candidates. It's the people who are on media. It's the people who are speaking. It's the people who are talking. So I'm going to give you a little grounding in the enormity of the problem of foreign policy and why it doesn't respond too well to simple explanations, which is the same problem with the enormity of the economy, which is a force of nature that doesn't respond well to simple explanations like all the people who are really wealthy have all the money, see, and that's why we're having these problems. What problems? It doesn't define the problem. It doesn't define a potential or two or three potential pathways to solutions, and it may not even necessarily be true because it depends on how you measure it. See what I'm saying? These things are complicated, and somebody needs to say, hang on a second before you start flipping out. So we'll talk about that. All right. So as I'm sitting here talking about foreign policy and all this crazy stuff going on, you know what passed through my mind? And I was thinking about this podcast, and I was thinking, I'm going to talk about ex-government cars. What am I going to say? Well, what you need is you need to have your ex-government car or truck so you can have your authority mojo together. And that's where ex-government trucks comes in. It's kind of a joke, but I can guarantee you there's no road rage when you're driving around in a Crown Vic or a police Yukon, right? The ex-government trucks mega truck center is now open in Forest Lake, Minnesota. They also have the great ex-government cars there. 356 19th Street, they have a huge selection of Ford trucks, Chevy trucks, Dodge trucks, Toyotas. They also have the Crown Vics, the Ford police sedans, the Dodge Chargers. Fast financing for all credit levels at exgovernmentcars.com. And right now, if you bring in your refund documents, they can count that as your down payment and you're good to go. They also have a 3-day peace of mind guarantee, which means you buy with confidence. So if you're looking for a work truck, SUV, van, or just a car, a second car or a car for your kid, don't forget exgovernmentcars.com. They also take trades. They pay the highest values every day without all the bull. Exgovernmenttrucks.com, exgovernmentcars.com in Forest Lake, 356 19th Street, or you can call them at 763-777-8782. I know they got a lot of cars up in Forest Lake if you want to snake through the lot and check it out. And yes, I have the bullhorn.
Exgovernmentcars.com.
And this is the other problem with trying to write this out and trying to think about this in a way that seems produced, because my mind is works so fast, and it's better for me just to sit and talk about it. Okay, so I mentioned I was going to talk about foreign policy, and I'm going to start with the reaction to the Brussels bombing. So just prior to the Brussels bombing, which now people say was a false flag attack, which who knows what that means, Donald Trump was set to make a speech at AIPAC, which is the big Jewish lobby convention, whatever it is, in New York, where almost every candidate goes to cut their foreign policy teeth. And they always go and they make a serious speech about foreign policy, and people read it and watch it and make comments about whether or not this was the right speech to give at this convention or this group, and you know whether or not this person has the chops to talk about foreign policy, and on it goes. And I guess they invited all the candidates to come and address the thing. And Trump got a big round of applause because he said this is the last year of the Obama administration. And most people who support Israel can't stand the president because they don't feel he's been a strong enough supporter of Israel. And so he got a big round of applause, and AIPAC apologized, which I thought once again that he got 24 hours of headlines until the Brussels attack occurred because he said that. The Brussels attack helped Trump because he's the guy who's been saying, don't let these people in. They're all terrorists, or they could be. And until we know what's going on, we need to get control of our borders, which is a fairly reasonable thing to say, although it's not doesn't seem reasonable the way he says it or the way people react to it. And then the Brussels bombing occurs, and you know it turns out that there are now apparently, at least according to AP, you know, is it true? I don't know. Supposedly, a number of interlocking terror cells operating in Europe who are being run by ISIS. And again, it's AP. It's a couple of different sources in the French and the Iraqi and the U.S. government, and it remains to be seen whether this is a boogeyman or whether this is something that has some substance to it. So we'll have to wait for more reporting. So the first thing that I want to say is generally when there is some major news story that is a breaking story like this kind of an attack, there are any number of people who rush to judgment to tell people what happened, why it happened, how this is going to happen again, and which it most assuredly will, and why it happened and what we need to do about it today, as though that's going to solve this intractable problem of using a tactic which is an asymmetric warfare tactic. It is the low budget equivalent of a missile system. Basically, it's an intelligent missile system that can be directed at the beast, which is the large governments of Europe and the United States and other Russia or whoever else, China, whoever else they decide they want to attack, because large countries have difficulties in responding to these asymmetric threats. That's what it is at its worst, and that's what it is at its best. In terms of what's causing it, well, that's a huge academic argument in the foreign policy and defense community in terms of dealing with it. And there is no simple explanation for what it is or how. In terms of foreign policy, let me just put it to you this way, and I hear this all the time. We've got to stop giving these countries foreign aid. This is, first of all, we're broke and we're giving these people money. And that was one of the things that Trump said this week. We shouldn't be protecting South Korea. We're giving them money and we get nothing from it. And we're giving Europe money and protecting Europe and we get nothing from it. And we shouldn't be giving anybody foreign aid. So here's a question for you, and I'll give you an answer a little bit later on in the podcast if I remember it. How much of the U.S. budget does foreign aid account for, and what is it used for? So just put that in your pocket, and I'll tell you the answer in a little while, a few minutes in this podcast. Why do we defend Europe? Why is it that the European militaries are essentially defensive in structure and weak? Why is that? Why does NATO exist? What was the purpose of NATO? And the answer is, here's the thing. We went to war in Europe in World War I. You could debate whether we should have, whether it was a misadventure by Woodrow Wilson and progressives that we were going to make the world right and we were going to right all the world's problems and we were going to create this League of Nations. And we went over and the Europeans basically had bled themselves white fighting World War I. In fact, there's a couple of books which suggest, and I didn't even know this. This is really an interesting fact. The Germans were a little more judicious about how they fought and how they used their troops. And so they were actually in a better position at the end of the war than the French or the English. If the United States hadn't stepped in and fought with the quote-unquote allies, it's very possible that the World War I would have been fought to a stalemate and would have had a negotiated settlement. And one wonders then if that had happened, whether or not there would have been a World War II. But in any case, we went over there and we were the deciding factor in the Allies winning World War I, primarily because we fought as a unit, and we learned anti-trench warfare tactics and were able to basically win the war. If we had done that, who knows what would have happened. But in the long run, it didn't solve the European problem, because what happened was they almost all immediately started to rearm and they started into this offensive struggle, which in the interwar period, because the United States withdrew from the situation, and that's where the word isolationist comes from. Over a million people marched in New York City in the summer of 1941 because they were marching against Lend-Lease and what looked like was going to eventually become U.S. involvement at that point was a war between England and France and Germany and Poland. So it's very interesting that the anti-war community at that time was Republican. The Democrats, in the form of Franklin Roosevelt, were pushing for a Lend-Lease, and they were pushing to get involved because they saw that this war was not going to go away and that we were going to end up in it one way or the other. So we ended up fighting a world war, that took millions and millions of lives. 30 million people in Russia, God knows how many people in Europe, and about a million U.S. casualties, as I recall. I can could be wrong about that, but it was somewhere around that. Almost everybody knew somebody whose family had lost one or two. My mother was going to marry a guy who was, killed in Europe. And so when the war was over and she met my dad, the guy that she was going to marry, who she was basically engaged to, although I don't think that they were engaged, but they would have been, was killed. So almost everybody knew somebody that had been killed in that war. So when it was over and it was ended with nuclear weapons, in the light of the nuclear age, they developed a number of institutions, foreign policy and, defense structures that were designed to keep the countries of Europe weak because they were concerned about another offensive struggle between the countries of Europe. And right after that, you had people like the mayor of Berlin, famous, Willy Brandt, who and others who really worked toward bringing in the European Union because they felt that free trade and defensive military structures would lead to peace. NATO developed as a counterweight, the Warsaw Pact developed as a counterweight to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and eventually NATO became a structure to contain the Soviet Union. So that's sort of a little bit of the history of NATO. I'm sure I'm probably wrong about a couple of things, but the idea was to keep Europe weak so that we didn't have another major war on our hand. And really, the same thing happened in Asia with Japan. We created the South Atlantic, CETO, and then the Pacific, the same types of defense structures in the Pacific to protect Japan, eventually to contain the Soviet Union through the UN war in South Korea, which is very interesting because Harry Truman did not want to get involved in the Korean conflict. But he didn't want to get involved with the UN, but I think what he wanted to do is he felt that if we didn't fight the Russians and the Chinese as a United Nations group, then the UN, which was a newly created structure to allow for negotiation between belligerents and to prevent nuclear war, would never get off the ground. So he invaded South Korea. We went into South Korea, after we got pushed out, we went into South Korea and fought the Korean War, really as an effort to shore up the United Nations. Again, agree or disagree, should we have been there? Shouldn't we have been there? Those were the reasons that were offered and which are part of history to be there. Very complicated, isn't it? And so foreign aid and defense structures that cost money and defense postures that involve packages of weapon systems and troops and ships and planes and things of that nature and weapon systems that are designed to do certain things are all part of the defense structure to meet certain potential threats. Most of us have grown up in a time which we refer to as bilateral. In other words, there was a Soviet sphere and there was American sphere. And the American sphere included Europe and parts of Latin America and parts of Asia. And the Russians tried to test those defenses, those forward defenses, let's call them, across the world, here and there. And then out of all that structure, we developed the mutual assured destruction theories and, game theory became part of the defense structure. And we had people like Curtis LeMay putting together Strategic Air Command. And we had all sorts of artifacts from that are now part of our history and part of our sociology, the fear of nuclear war and things like that. We are now living in something called a multipolar world. And what I might even refer to as an asymmetric world where we don't know where threats are going to come from. We don't know the nature of those threats. We don't know the impact of those threats. And we are challenged to come up with defense systems that will address those threats. Somebody on Fox News foolishly said, well, if there's a picture of these terrorists bringing these bombs in, how come the Brussels police didn't do anything about it? As though they would have known that that picture was terrorists, right? Things like that don't serve anyone. So I guess what I'm suggesting is, even though we've had a terror problem since 9/11 and really since the 1970s with the Palestinians, and really that we have had this issue with the West interfacing with the Middle Eastern countries as well as the East, and not just Russia, but China and so forth, and with people of different faiths and different cultures and everything else trying to interface, we've had this problem now for a long time. It only became apparent that it was getting asymmetric and out of control when the Twin Towers were attacked on 9/11. Now, if you already believed it was an inside job and, you know, it was a false flag attack, then no amount of reason is going to convince you, and you may as well just turn the podcast off. But once we were attacked on 9/11, then we suddenly realized that we had to come up with some new ways to defend ourselves, and we've been struggling with it ever since. They created the Department of Homeland Security. They created, you know, a stepped-up NSA, which everyone's pissed off about because we don't like being surveilled, and it causes all kinds of problems with the Fourth Amendment. You got the waterboarding situation. You've got all kinds of problems with drone attacks that make people who are the victims of drone attacks, whether they're collateral damage or not, angry, and then they become activists or they sign up for the terror war. We went and invaded Iraq, which some would suggest we shouldn't have done. And, you know, now that's a mess because we destabilized that whole region, and on it, and they had the Arab Spring. And then the current president, Obama, decided to take a different tack. And there's a whole argument about whether or not it's working or not. So we're living in a multipolar, which means many different power centers, and perhaps even asymmetric, which means an unpredictable level of threat from unpredictable sources. And we still haven't developed the tools necessary to address it. And it's going to take a number of years for us to figure this out one way or the other. And it's going to end up taking a mix of economic involvement and defense preparation and new weapon systems and all sorts of things before we figure this out. And paramount in this discussion is what you believe about how we defend the citizens of the United States. Do we defend them at our shores? Do we defend them do we put the furthest line of defense in Europe? Do we put it in the Middle East? Do we put it in Asia somewhere? Do we put it in Mexico or Central America? You know, where do we defend America? So that's an important, really salient question, which no one is talking about. No one has suggested, hey, we need to talk about, you know, where our defensive, our first line of defense, our picket line, so to speak, is in the world. And that answers a lot of other questions. Another thing you're going to have to answer for yourself is, are you someone that believes in free trade? Or, in other words, should you be able to trade with anybody in the world that you want to trade with? And should they be able to trade with you? Or are you a trade protectionist? And do you think we should lock up the borders and only trade with Americans? Are you someone that believes that the international banking system is part of the conspiracy and we need to eliminate the international banks? How do you do that? Where are the lines of defense? Who are we going to trade with? And if we're going to trade with the world, we're going to have allies and we're going to have, you know, enemies, frenemies or whatever. How do we protect our allies? How do we maintain relations with potentially destructive enemies so that we don't have big wars? How do we protect ourselves against various types of illegal contraband if we're going to say, hey, I think marijuana's okay, but I don't think heroin's okay. Okay. So what tools are you going to use to stop the flow of illegal heroin or methamphetamines or something like that? I mean, those are just a few of these questions that are involved with foreign policy. Now, I do believe that we need to be more vigilant and focused on protecting our borders. We need to know who's in this country, what they're doing here, where they live, and they're not citizens, and they do not have the same rights that American citizens have. And I do think that we need to make it clear that American citizens have certain rights, and that if you want to come here, then you can live here and you can become an American citizen, but you have to go through the process. But we also have to make it easy for people to go through that process, and we have to help them go through the process. But we need to be careful about who we let into the country for various and obvious reasons, if you want to believe the AP story about the Brussels attackers or the Paris attackers being brought in as interlocking terror cells because ISIS is trying to penetrate Europe. If they do that here, we're going to have other kinds of problems. Moreover, how do Americans protect themselves against this kind of violence? You know, if we are going to be unarmed, if you support someone who is for removing firearms from the homes of Americans, which is our constitutional right, how are we going to protect ourselves against potential attackers? So there's a lot of complicated questions that cannot be answered with little stories about the Illuminati or, rhetorical flourishes by people like Ted Cruz and Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And more than likely, they're not going to get solved in a future, administration or two. Do you want to be involved in another huge war, which costs the United States trillions of dollars, which involves deploying U.S. troops all over the place? And if the answer is yes, but we're going to make our allies pay for it, how much money do they have? You realize that American citizens are the 1% in general. All American, all 350-some million American people are the upper 1% of the world's population. Most countries are dirt poor. Most countries have almost nothing. You look at the GDP in dollar amounts from Iraq and Syria and compare it to the European Union or the United States, which are $19 trillion economies, and it's no wonder those people want to come here. You'd want to come here too if you were someplace else. You'd want to come to Australia or Great Britain or the United States or France or someplace where you might be able to get a job and make some money and feed your family. I'm not saying we should let them in. I'm not saying we should let in people who could be potentially terrorists. But, I can understand why people in war-torn hellholes would want to come to the United States, and they have for years, and I get it. But, I guess what I'm saying in this podcast, and I'm going to close it, and I'm coming up towards the end here. So, U.S. foreign aid accounts for how much of the United States budget? Most people think it accounts for 28% of the U.S. budget, which is really amazing because defense doesn't even account for 28% of the U.S. budget. The entitlements, defense, generally account for most of the expenditures of the U.S. budget, including non-discretionary spending. Foreign aid accounts for 1%, slightly less than 1% of the federal budget of the United States. And if we give a country foreign aid, then we can also take it away, which gives us a little skin in the game. So when people go out and bitch and moan about foreign trade, it really shows how ignorant they are concerning how this country conducts its foreign business. Same with free trade. We are wealthy in America comparatively because we have engaged in free trade. Smoot-Hawley, which was a trade protection act in the late 20s and early 30s, is what caused the depression in the United States. We have a situation where if we elect the wrong leaders, they can make egregious mistakes. And we can be all pissed off about what's going on, and we can demand change and all these other things. But if you don't know the details of foreign policy, if you don't know the answers to some of these questions that come up in foreign policy or economics, and you pick the wrong guy and they do something stupid like Smoot-Hawley, it's going to affect all of us. Or they do something stupid like invade Iraq, it's going to affect us all. So, and those are just a few of the questions. What are you going to do about China? How do you handle a potential breakup of China because of an economic depression there? How are you going to handle Russia? How are you going to handle the Ukraine? How are you going to handle developing economies in Africa and Latin America? And really, giants like Brazil and Argentina and Mexico, how are you going to handle Asia? 280 million people in Indonesia. Think about that. Indonesia has almost as many people as the United States. What about Singapore and Hong Kong? And, the list goes on and on and on. There are all kinds of places that can develop into problems, or they can be allies or places we can trade with and various other things. Nobody's talking about that. All we're talking about is we better not let those people in here, which is, to me, that's academic. I don't even see why there's a discussion about that. So we're not getting into depth on these issues. And what's happening is people are talking about conspiracy theory as though that passes for an academic discussion of foreign policy. And I haven't even gotten into where foreign policy comes from. What are the schools of foreign policy? And, how do you find the people in the State Department and the executive branch and Congress to, enact the laws and figure out which way we want to go and why and vet these different options? Because guess what? Foreign policy, like law, like defense policy, like economic policy, doesn't come out of a can. Some guy doesn't wake up one day and go, I want to do this and have it happen, because there are other people who are going to say, no, don't do that. There are vested interests. Like all things in this country, it ends up being complicated. But that doesn't stop us from wanting simple solutions to problems. And what happened when we had a simple solution problem? Simple solution to the problem, we're going to invade Iraq, which actually is the one single thing that has destroyed the Republican Party. It's not Donald Trump that's destroyed the Republican Party. It was the invasion of Iraq that destroyed the Republican Party, because he got in, we knew what we were going to do, we just didn't know what we were going to do afterwards. And it's destabilized the whole region. And I understand why they did it, but that was the stake that has been driven through the heart of the Republican Party. They've never recovered from that. I could do a whole podcast about that. There's just no time to discuss it, but you see the enormity of these problems. Now, you can just turn your head and say, well, I don't care, I just want it fixed. And I understand that. But in terms of making a decision about who should be president, and I'm not supporting any of them, I'm really tired of the pedantic, elementary explanations of what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And I think that's how we got into trouble in the first place. And I'd prefer not to have to go through that again. I'd like to be able to learn from my mistakes. Yeah, with all this craziness, I just have to keep doing yoga, because it's the only thing that keeps me sane. And I'm very happy when I practice yoga, because I get to drink Hydrus. And of course, I'm not sure which came first, the Hydrus. Well, I know the yoga came first. And what I would do is when you do yoga, you're in crowded rooms of over 100 degrees, you have high humidity, you sweat a lot. I talk about it all the time, except I never realized how dehydrated you get. And the thing is, you can drink a huge amount of water before a yoga class, but the water, we've learned, doesn't take effect until about 45 minutes. So you see people overheat because they're dehydrated. And then later you're sore because you got dehydrated and your muscles didn't get a chance to recover. And then I found Hydrus. Hydrus transformed my yoga practice because I'm fully hydrated and electrolytes are getting into my muscles. And it doesn't matter if you do cycle, if you do CrossFit, if you are a lifter, and I know people that are really into this stuff and they work really hard, whatever kind of competitive sport that you do, or whatever kind of competitive sport that people that you love do, Hydrus makes a huge difference. It's a new high-performance beverage that you dilute into water that uses exclusive nanosome technology to deliver critical electrolytes with unrivaled speed and effectiveness. But here's the thing, there's no sugar that you have in traditional sports drinks, so it's great. It's great for wrestlers to make weight cuts. It's great for tennis. It's great for all kinds of stuff. Here's why I like it. I like it because Hydrus helps me take it to the edge. And in yoga, the edge is where you grow. The edge is where you get better at your practice. The edge is where you learn. So that is where I want to be. And that is what it is all about. So here's what you do. Join the performance hydration revolution. Visit HydrusPerformance.com. That's HYDRUS, HydrusPerformance.com. It's great. I use it every single day. I use scads of it every single day. And I love it. HydrusPerformance.com. If you go to that website, it'll tell you all kinds of stuff about Hydrus, and you can learn more about it and purchase samples and everything else, and you can find out for yourself what Hydrus does. And thanks, Hydrus, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcasts. All right, thanks to Brush Studio in the West End. If you want to put together a client appreciation party, this is the place to do it. Brushstudio.net. Thanks to X-Government Cars, xgovernmentcars.com. I don't think there's any more I can say about xgovernmentcars.com. I've had 3 Crown Vics and now, of course, Mobile Podcast Command, and I love it. And of course, thanks also to Hydrus, which I'm using extensively in yoga to take my practice to the edge, as I just said. If you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. They started the angle of attack revolution. It's always great to have a visual representation when you're making that final turn on final approach. The bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Click on the Alpha Systems banners at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator. You just go at the top of the BobDavisPodcast.com and you'll see their banner. And thanks again, you guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcasts. Well, this is a little bit longer podcast, and I kind of have been experimenting with slightly longer podcasts, so let me know what you think. And thanks for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, and thanks for liking and sharing and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I'm BDavis7843 on Instagram, which I love. I think it's the best social media. And thanks for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening. All those donations, of course, go right to Mobile Podcast Command, and I'll tell you more about that going forward. Thanks for listening to podcast 480, Foreign Policy.
We've got a passion. We've got a passion. It's called peace. We've got a passion. We've got a passion. We've got a passion.